Well, it's a delight to be here, and my time is short, so I'm going to jump right in. So what I'm going to speak to you today about is this general question about human origins and the species problem, which is a biologist issue, and particularly how it pertains to human biology. But I'll start with just some introductory remarks about evolution in general. Evolution in science is a theory in science. One of the things my students have to learn early on is that what a theory is in science is not what a theory is in common English usage. So a theory is an accurate framework that makes accurate predictions that has not yet been falsified. Evolution, as my students come to learn it and others, they come to understand that evolution very strongly supports a few hypotheses that are commonly thought to be at odds with Christian convictions. And the two that we commonly wrestle with are these, that humans are the product of an evolutionary process, that we do indeed share common ancestors with other forms of life. And this other one has sort of dropped onto the evangelical radar in the last few years more overtly, and that is the evidence strongly supports the idea that humans came into being through an evolutionary process as a population rather than from a single ancestral couple, so from a population of about 10,000 individuals. So that's sort of the things that are sort of on the evangelical consciousness right now. Common ancestry, but also population sizes, and how or, you know, where might Adam and Eve fit into that picture, if at all. So this is an extension of the species problem in biology. If you ever want a good hour-long conversation, ask a biologist, you know, what's a species? How do you define it? And be prepared. You will have a long conversation. The idea here is this, and this goes back to Darwin's observations, the idea that populations might become genetically separated in some way. This means that genetic changes in one population, you know, that are accumulating either through mutation or recombination, that they're no longer being averaged across both groups as they're now genetically isolated from one another. This means that differences might accumulate, that differences could add up over time, average characteristics of the two groups could change. And if you let this go on long enough, you may end up with new species over time. Now, the issue here is that this is a gradient. There is no convenient point along this gradient where you can say, here's where we have the new species and now they're separate from one another. This is actually very similar to how languages form. And I often use this as an analogy to help non-biologists understand how this process is taking place. Languages also form as population-level phenomena as populations become separated. So average characteristics of these populations might change. There might be language changes, syntax, spelling, neologisms, that sort of things. Those sort of things, they're not averaged across populations once they've separated from one another. So again, just like with biological species, we can see differences that accumulate, average characteristics can change. And if you give this process enough time, this will lead to the formation of new languages where groups are no longer mutually intelligible to each other. So one way to think about this is that both languages and species are population-level information systems. They're subject to imperfect copying. I sometimes joke and say, you know, anybody who's a grandparent knows that language changes over time because your grandkids, they do speak English, but it's a slightly different English than the one that you grew up with. Okay. As Christians, we're actually somewhat familiar with this phenomenon because we're used to reading texts from the Christian tradition from different time periods in history. So if I put this up on the slide and say, here's English, some of you will say, well, okay, there's the English professor in the back nodding his head, but the rest of us are looking at it and going, this isn't English, this is English. This is actually John 1:29 from the West Saxon Gospels from about the year 990. I love this example because it's got Middle Earth in it. So if you're a Tolkien fan, there you go. There's my nod to Tolkien. Now, if we were to read this in a modern translation, here's the NIV from 2011, it makes perfect sense to us. It's understandable. Now, it's only in some academic sense that I can say that this is the same language as this. But yet, we know that this is actually, these two examples are connected by a continuous population of speakers with a process of incremental change over time. And throwing in some other examples from other points in Christian history and different translations and editions of the Bible will bring this point into sharp relief. What we're looking at are discrete samples from what is, in fact, a continuous process over time. It's decidedly difficult to draw a line on that gradient. And it's hard to draw a line on that gradient for languages and how they form, and it's also, by analogy, very hard to draw a line on a gradient of biological change over time. Okay. So the shift in average characteristics over time of a language or a species means that sometimes you're going to get new species, sometimes you're going to get new languages, but the process is a gradient. And the gradual nature of the process by which these entities, either languages or species, are formed makes it very difficult to draw a line of demarcation on that gradient. In some senses, any attempt to draw a line on this gradient is going to be arbitrary in some sense. One way to sort of illustrate this would be to ask this question: who was the first speaker of modern English? Now, that's not a question that Christians are typically that interested in answering, but this one very much is. Who was the first human? If humans are the product of an evolutionary process that is a gradual incremental process over time, it's similarly difficult to draw a line of demarcation on that gradient. Okay, so I'm just going to give you a brief overview of one of the lines of evidence that complicate this problem, or complicate this question of who's the first human. The first issue that sort of complicates the problem, or complicates the question, is that this idea that humans do not descend from an ancestral couple, but the evidence supports that we descend from a population rather than a pair. So, at present, there's no evidence to support anything other than a minimum population size of about 10,000 individuals. We've done a number of different ways of sort of estimating ancestral population sizes in our lineage, and they all come out to about this 10,000 number. There's the ways that the techniques that have been used to estimate this value, many of them are independent from one another, but yet they converge on this same answer. And as a scientist, I'm always happy to see multiple different approaches that are independent of one another that are converging on that same estimate. It gives us increased confidence that what we're looking at is real. So despite their limitations, and all scientific methods do have limitations, all of these methods that we've applied to date indicate that we come from this population of about 10,000 individuals. So here's one way that you can do this. This will be the most technical part of the talk. If this next 5 minutes, if you go to sleep and then come back afterwards, it's all good. One way to do this is to actually look at DNA in present-day people. And this particular technique looks at individuals. Any individual person is going to inherit one copy of their DNA from their mom, one copy of each gene or allele from their dad. You can take those different variants within one person and compare how different they are to one another. Now, if you have two variants that are very, very similar to each other, then they likely come from a common ancestral sequence in the very recent past, because they only have a very small number of differences. On the other hand, you might be able to find differences within one individual where there's actually quite a large difference between the two copies of the information that they have. In this case, there's a larger time span that we would have to go back in time before those two sequences become the same sequence. So what we're estimating when we're looking at variation in a present-day person is how long ago did a given sequence come from a most recent common ancestor? So a time to a most recent common ancestor is what we're looking at for any given pair of variants. So if you think about two different variants of a gene in the present day, that's what we call alleles. They have these differences that arose through mutations over time. So what we're really sort of doing is we're mentally working backwards and reversing mentally each of those mutations until we come to a time when there's no mutations that separate them and they coalesce. They come back to that same common ancestral point. And we're interested in what time that's happening at. Now, here's the interesting thing. The probability of coalescence is directly related to the size of the population. If you have a small population, mating is much more likely to occur between close relatives. And as a result, the probability of coalescence that you share very recent variation with other people around you is much, much higher. In a large population, this is much less of a factor, such that coalescence is very unprobable, very improbable in a large population. So what we can do using this analysis is simply look at present-day genomes, measure the time to most recent common ancestor values for different variants at different points along a genome, and then generate a statistical distribution to say, okay, in this individual's history, Are there time points in their past where probability of coalescence is high? Is there times in their past when the probability of coalescence is low? And that allows you to estimate in their lineage what their population size looked like as you go back in time. Okay, so this is that. All of that is just to give you some insight into this figure. This is what happens when you actually do this analysis on present-day humans. So what you're looking at here is an estimate of population size on the one axis and time in the past on another axis. Another way to think about this is that this is just the probability of coalescence at a given time point in the past. And what you can see as you look back in human history, this is for six different people groups, from present-day people groups. You'll notice that as you go back in time, there comes a time point where the population sizes are grouping together. And then there comes a time when sub-Saharan African populations and non-sub-Saharan African populations begin to diverge from each other. We can see that sub-Saharan populations maintain a relatively large population size, and anyone who's not recently derived from sub-Saharan African populations goes through a smaller population size. So we see sub-Saharan African populations maintaining an effective population size in the thousands, but non-sub-Saharan African populations are maintaining a population size that's dipping down to about 1,000, 1,200 or so. Okay. So that's one line of evidence. As we look at the genetic diversity that's present in present-day humans, we see this particular pattern. And you'll notice, if we go back to that slide, that nowhere in here do we see that dip to 2 that we might sort of expect. That's one line of evidence that sort of puts some data on the table. Another line of evidence that's become increasingly relevant in recent years is this idea of paleogenomics. We've been able in recent years to access and sequence the DNA of species that no longer exist. And some of those species are closely related to humans. So what this data has shown is that not only do humans maintain a very large, substantial population size during our history, but we also have limited genetic exchange with other groups on the planet as we evolve in Africa, migrate out of Africa, and encounter these other groups that have left Africa before we do. So just don't worry, there's not a test at the end of this, but if Homo sapiens is up here, we share common ancestors with other groups like Neanderthals, the Denisovans, Homo erectus, and so on. So phylogenetically, or sort of this family tree of relatedness, we have this branching pattern. But what I'm about to show you is that this nice, clean, tidy picture is not so nice and clean. We actually have genetic exchange in this area as well, which further complicates the picture. So the first sort of shot across the bow with this issue was Neanderthals. We started sequencing Neanderthal mitochondrial DNA and then later on their genomic DNA. And this showed us that we do have some present-day humans do descend from, in part, from Neanderthals. This was a second round, sort of a second issue, with this group called the Denisovans. Another hominin that was found. Hominins are just species that are more closely related to humans than they are to chimpanzees. And what we see with the Denisovans is that this is a measure of human-human variation for mitochondrial DNA. If you take individual humans and compare them to each other, you get this sort of distribution of differences. Neanderthals sit outside of that variation. And Denisovans, which was interesting at the time, not only sit outside the human range, but they're also outside of the Neanderthal range as well. So this is something different. It's not human, it's not Homo sapiens, it's not Neanderthals. It's a separate group. And I quipped last night that there's altogether too many Denises involved in this conversation, but now there's Denisovans as well, so my apologies. Okay. So this is a group that is closely related to Neanderthals. So these are all different Neanderthal groups, individuals that have been sequenced. Denisovans share a more recent common ancestor with Neanderthals than they do with present-day Homo sapiens groups. So, as I mentioned before, sequencing of these genomes has revealed that this nice, tidy picture is no longer nice and tidy, so that we have a further complication in that we have genetic exchange between these different groups as well. So the question then becomes, and this is just an image to show you sort of how the picture is complicated now, we have modern-day humans, Homo sapiens here. We share a common ancestor with the common ancestor of Denisovans and Neanderthals at about 700,000 years ago. These groups leave Africa before we do. And when we migrate out of Africa, we actually have an encounter with these different species, and we have a limited amount of genetic exchange between them. So there's some variation that flows from Neanderthals into some modern-day humans. Anyone who's not sub-Saharan African has some of their genome that comes from Neanderthals. Other groups have DNA that are coming from Denisovans, and so on. This future or other work that's been done in this area has also, again, further complicated the picture. There's some interesting results that suggest that the Denisovans, this lineage, actually had some genetic exchange with some other unknown group as well. And that group diverges off at about a million years ago or so. So the question then really becomes, you know, Adam, where art thou? I sometimes joke about this with my students, that sometimes there's sort of an attempt to sort of pin the Adam on the phylogeny, but where do you put Adam, right? It's an interesting question. It's one that Christians are wrestling with. There's two recent sort of proposals or hypotheses that have been floated, and these are in response to some of the work that I've done, and they're friendly critics of the work that I've done, to ask this question. Okay, well, perhaps we can actually have an ancient genetic Adam. Oops. If we place that Adam far enough back. So this would be prior to 700,000 years ago before there's this division. Another approach that's a recent, has become sort of promoted recently by this individual, Joshua Swamidas, is this idea that maybe we have a recent genealogical Adam. So this is not a genetic progenitor of all present-day individuals, but is a genealogical ancestor of all present-day individuals. So the first one, this ancient genetic Adam, was suggested by this individual named Richard Buggs, who's a geneticist in the United Kingdom. And his ideas are these. He was saying, okay, Dennis, you've done some, you know, a reasonable description of the science as it stands, but here's something that potentially you're missing. What if we had an instantaneous reduction in population size from about that 10,000 down to 2 in a single generation? And then after this event, you have exponential population growth right after that. So you go from sort of that steady state of 2,000, boom, down to 2, and then exponential population growth after that. Interestingly enough, we had a discussion about this. We got some help from some other people to do some modeling and whatnot. And the result of that is to say, yeah, actually, that kind of event would be missed by population genomics methods if it occurred any time between the present day and 700,000 years ago. So that nice sort of steady state diagram that I've shown you, if you had that sort of instantaneous reduction and then immediate explosive population growth thereafter, that would be missed. Now, the challenge to that hypothesis, of course, is where and how is this sort of event going to take place? Hominins are really widespread at 700,000 years ago. They're down in Asia and such and whatnot. So the idea is how could you propose, like, what sort of event would wipe out all hominins on the planet except 2 and then immediately allow for exponential population growth immediately thereafter? So that's sort of the challenge for that particular hypothesis. Nobody's really been able to postulate a probable or reasonable explanation for that possibly happening. Now, just remember, there's no evidence that this actually took place. The evidence we have is these population sizes with the various methods. But Buggs is saying, but maybe this happened and we've missed it. So that's one hypothesis on the table right now. The other hypothesis or the other challenge for this, of course, is this potential introgression event would push it further back in time. Of course, the main issue for that particular hypothesis is that 700,000 years ago doesn't look anything like Genesis 1 and 2. 700,000 years ago is Homo erectus. That's not Homo sapiens and such. Okay. The other critic recently is, friendly critic, is Joshua Swamidas, who has published a paper in Perspectives recently on genealogy, a recent genealogical Adam and Eve. So in this model, Adam and Eve are selected or created in the Middle East 6,000 years ago. Adam and Eve are the first true humans. Adam and Eve's descendants then interbreed with the biologically compatible Homo sapiens population that's around them, and eventually all Homo sapiens become fully human because they've genetically or genealogically descended from Adam and Eve. Now, this would then have an event that occurs about 6,000 years ago in the Middle East. So this is after the migration out of Africa. So then in order to become human, different populations around the planet would have to wait until they encounter Adam's lineage and interbreed with it. So the challenges for this model is that humanness, whatever constitutes humanness, is now being transmitted genealogically. So this means that there's a large number of anatomically modern and behaviorally modern Homo sapiens around the planet that would not qualify as truly human until they encounter and interbreed with Adam's line coming from Mesopotamia. Okay, so just in conclusion, human speciation, like speciation in general, is a biological gradient. Drawing lines of demarcation on a gradient like that is always going to be arbitrary, at least in some sense. There are models of Adam and Eve where you have a historical Adam and Eve that do not require genealogical descent, so federal headship models would be one option there. So the idea that Adam and Eve are selected representatives and their fall somehow affects the rest of humans around them. So we're not talking about genealogical humanness being transmitted. And then the last thing I would mention is that models that don't employ a literal Adam and Eve are, of course, going to be robust to future advances in paleogenomics. And with that, I'll thank you and ask for questions. Yes, there.
Where are the data points? Is this solid line here?
Yep.
So is the data point when the branch occurs, is that the data point? And then the other data points at the end of that line? Or are there some data points in between the branch and that input?
How do you mean data point? We have DNA sequences for all of these different groups.
Right, so you don't have any data points at the branching, so you don't have another group that's there then. So you're assuming that this is where the branching occurs, or are there other points where there's been genetics been tested?
It's not an assumption. It's okay. Based on the same principles that we would use at a smaller scale to determine relatedness among individuals, like say within this room, for example. So what you're looking at is a diagram that represents how similar genetically individuals or groups are to each other. So we can quite confidently say that, you know, all of these individuals here are modern day Homo sapiens, and this is the arrangement of their genetic similarity to each other.
Okay, so you have the four, because they have four different genome basically, and then you're saying that those two come together at a certain point, but there's no actual individual genetics to test that point.
So no, we've done this based on sequencing genomes.
Okay, so that's why I'm saying where are the actual data points. Are the data points only at the end of those lines then?
That you well, this sequence? This is what we have in the present day that we can do sequencing on.
Okay, on the end. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Looking at the bugs hypothesis, has anybody suggested it links up to Noah's flood? And second question about the Swammerdass model. We have two parents, four grandparents, eight great-grandparents, and 10^1,000 for our ancestors 1,000 generations ago, which corresponds to this population of about 10,000 approximately. So if among those 10,000 people, every one of them would be an ancestor to the ones 1,000 generations later, so couldn't you pick out one of them, call him Adam, and another one and call her Eve, and have the two from whom everybody would have as ancestors?
So the first question, has anybody connected Bugs' model to a global flood? Not that I'm aware. I'm not sure what Bugs' views are on the global flood. There's no geological evidence for such an event, so I can't say much beyond that because I'm not a geologist. On the second point, genealogically it works. There's not an issue with the science on the genealogy side of the equation. The question is if you have a genealogical Adam and Eve that are transmitting humanness in some way to the biologically compatible beings around them, then it's simply going to take a certain amount of time for that to spread across the planet. So you will have a time on the planet where you have individuals who are not distinguishable from each other, but some are true humans and some are not true humans. That's how that model would work.
Yeah, thanks. Very interesting talk. I wanted to see the other diagram, the one with the dip in it with the different colors.
Sure.
Backwards. Yeah, that one up there would be fine. You have a bigger one later. I'm just trying to understand how to interpret that diagram. It went by a bit fast. So on the horizontal axis is what? It's a logarithmic scale going backward in time?
This is backward in time. That's right.
In what? In years?
In years, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the vertical is the population size in units of 10,000 for the various groups.
That's correct.
So what is the divergence on the right-hand side way back when?
Way back here?
Yeah.
This is when the acknowledged power of the method fails. So basically you end up with sort of infinite population sizes. But that's just an artifact. This method is only usable within a certain bandwidth of time. And you'll also notice that the similar thing happens here in recent times. So it's a little much to get into all the details of the modeling, but scientists know that this method only really works within a certain bandwidth of time.
So just to understand, then there's this dip in, I don't know when, yep. A million years ago? No, the other dip.
This one
yeah,
here?
Yeah,
yep.
That guy. So does that mean there are a whole bunch of different population groups in these areas that are all roughly the same size?
This is actually one of the things that I skated past because there's not a lot of time, is what we're looking at here is effective population size. That's not necessarily the same thing as census size. So census size is the actual headcount of who's around. That is most likely quite a bit larger than actually effective population size. So effective population size is looking at the genetic diversity that we have in the present day and saying what size of group do we need to transmit that to us in the present day. So it's not exactly census size. It's an estimate of, it's the only estimate that we can make of census size using genetic techniques.
But it means the effective population size of all those guys is the same.
Yes, yes.
Why is that?
Most likely because they were one population at the time. So they're exchanging with each other.
They all were one population.
Yes, yes, yeah. And I mean, not to say that humans in the present day are not one population as well, but we had a time where there was regional separation, and that allowed for some differences to accumulate.
We'll have to thank our speaker.